The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Good evening, and I want to thank you for having me. I had a friend who sent me an email. I do a lot of flying. I'm sure there's some people here who also do a lot of flying. And there are all sorts of experiences when you fly on airplanes that are not really explainable. They come up with terms so that you think you know what's going on when really you don't. Wind shear is one such example. That's the technical term they give when the plane drops very suddenly a large amount of space and no one really knows exactly what's going on, right? And it's not a pleasant experience if you've ever been in wind shear. You're flying along, and all of a sudden, vroom, right? And the plane just drops. And I've been in a plane a couple of times. It's always fascinating to me to see. You discover very quickly who the veteran flyers are. They're the only ones without their heads between their knees. Anyway, so this friend was on an airplane, and they hit a very severe pocket of wind shear. The pilot had been making his standard announcements. You know, that's what pilots do. They need to tell you that they're on the plane flying. So they come up with some inane series of announcements. You know, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be flying at 35,000 feet. You'll be able to see the Alps on your left. Like, anybody really cares about this, but that's what they do. He just finished his announcements, and they hit this amazing wind shear. And the plane dropped like 1,000 feet, right? And the pilot, not realizing the mic was still on, said something that I can't really repeat in a synagogue or elsewhere. We'll say, holy bagel, right? Holy bagel! And, you know, if you're a passenger, and you're new to the experience of flying, and you hit wind shear nach, and the pilot screams out, holy bagel, right? This is not a good day for you. So, you know, people are assuming the position and panicking, and then the plane, of course, gets itself right, at which point the pilot suddenly realizes that he's left the microphone on, and that the passengers all heard him develop his relationship with bagels, right? So he gets back on the mic. He says, oh, ladies and gentlemen, I'm awfully sorry. I didn't realize the microphone was still on. At no point were you in any danger. It's just that I had a cup of coffee in my hands. You should see my pants. At which point, somebody from the rear of the airplane yells out, you should see mine, right? Sometimes, life is about perspective. It's not always exactly what you're experiencing, but where you're experiencing it from. And I think maybe one of the challenges is how we succeed in both perceiving that we have a very singular, unique, specific perspective, and that it is, in the end, our perspective, and not necessarily everybody's perspective. And it's very difficult to come to an objective perspective. And this particular topic, I think more than almost any other, reflects this challenge. I think we called it when someone you love does something you hate. There is a mitzvah in the Torah. The Torah teaches us in Parshat Kedoshim, right, which we'll be reading in a short while, a few weeks, Hocheach tochiach et amitecha, which literally means to reprove your colleague, your compatriot. You see somebody doing something wrong, and you have to tell them off. And some of us have a difficult time with that. Are we comfortable with being the tellers off, never mind being the told off? How do you know that what you're seeing is really what is? And I remember once in the army, we were on reserve duty, and it was the period right after Passover, right after Pesach, which is the counting of the Omer, right? I don't know enough about who is sitting here, but there is a, so some of you may be well aware of this and some of you aren't, but there's a mitzvah mentioned in the Torah that from the second day of Pesach, the second day of Passover, we count every day, 49 days, the counting of the Omer, right? And every evening, we get together in our synagogues or wherever we are, Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kedishanu Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu, Al Svirat HaOmer, we thank God for giving us the mitzvah to count the Omer. And it's an interesting mitzvah. We're counting the days from the barley sacrifice, counting towards Shavuot. We're counting up different levels, 7 times 7 weeks. And there are all sorts of mystical, Kabbalistic overtones to these days. There are seven different spheres that are mentioned, sfirot. Right? You begin with chesed, which is loving kindness and outward energy, and then you go on to gvura, which is inward energy, and then tiferet, which is a blend between the two, and the first week is chesed, and the first day of the first week is chesed shebechesed, right? And the second day is gvura shebechesed, because that's the first week, the second, and then all this stuff. So anyway, so we're in reserve duty, and these two guys are having a debate. Because it was a really slow afternoon. Is there such a thing as a purely secular Sephardi Jew? Does that exist? And if you know the Sephardic world in Israel, so the Sephardim, you know, much more traditional. There's just something that the Sephardic world, that we in the Ashkenaz world can really learn from. They've really succeeded in hanging on to the depth of Masoret of tradition. Right? So they're debating, is there such a thing as a Sephardi Chiloni? Is there such a thing as a secular Sephardi? If a person could ever be secular, if the word Chiloni makes any sense, what the word religious means, but put all that aside. So they came to me, because I'm the officer in the unit, but I'm the guy with the kippah, so I'm like the resident rabbi, and they said, "Nu bini mata chushev, what do you think? Is davar kaze Sephardi Chiloni? Do you think that there's such a thing as a Sephardi Chiloni?" Right? Now you have to understand, when you're in the army, you have to be very careful about venturing any sort of opinion which takes sides. This can have enormous overtones. So I didn't know what to say, because I didn't know who was saying what. One of these guys was the Rasap. He's the guy responsible for setting up all the rotations of guard duty. The last thing I want to do is to disagree with him. So I came up with the best solution. Why don't you ask Buzaglo? Every unit has a Buzaglo. This guy was ours. Buzaglo was the only guy in the unit who had tattoos. Right? Back then, nobody did tattoos. He had tattoos. We used to have a debate because official army doctrine, you weren't allowed to wear earrings in the army. He wanted to wear earrings. You know, we got him down from 3 earrings to 2 earrings. That was Buzaglo. You know? So if there was ever a guy who was Faradi and Chiloni, it would be him. And he was really, you know, he was the guy who used to boast, you know, what he used to do on Yom Kippur. He developed a relationship with God in very different ways. But okay, right? So they call Buzaglo over, and one of them says, he figures out, he'll figure whether he's a Chiloni or not. So he says to him, Buzaglo, tagidli. Do you know what the counting of the Omer is? They got to picture this guy, you know, earring, tattoos. I mean, looks at them, says, "Kalachem, what's the matter with you?" And he puts his hand on his head, and he says, "Ayom shlosh asar yom shem shavu achad v'shisha yamim laomer hod shebat tiferet." Right? Knew exactly what the Omer was. You look at a picture, and you think you know what you're looking at. And you have no idea what you're looking at. And I want you to understand the difficulty of this question. You see, if I'm supposed to tell off someone for doing something that is essentially wrong, right, and we're going to have to understand why, what that means, I have to know that what I'm seeing is a picture that's wrong. How do I know? You know, the truth is, this story is a really troubling story because it presumes that a person could be chiloni, secular. Or, for example, that a person could be religious. What does that word mean? And just so we're all on the same page here, and anybody who's ever met me, we've had this discussion before, because I think this is one of the pinnacles that we have to get out of the way. What does the word religious mean? Well, what does it mean to be religious? How do I know if a person is religious? I'll give you an example. Imagine for a moment that you see a fellow, okay? And, I don't know, you visit, you've been to Israel. How many people here have been to Israel? Oh, okay. Those of you who haven't, you have to come. Next week, there's a good flight. Okay. So let's say you go to Mea Shearim. Mea Shearim is a very religious neighborhood, whatever that means, ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, in Yerushalayim. And let's say that it's, it's Yom Kippur. And let's say Super Jew. Super Jew lives in Mea Shearim. He, and again, I'm using a stereotype. Stereotypes are horrible, horrible things. They're not based at all on reality, but just for the purpose of discussion. Super Jew lives in Mea Shearim. He has a long black coat. He has a long dark beard. He learns Talmud Daf Yomi every day, Bavli and Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud too. He prays three. He prays five times a day in case the Muslims are right. His cows are so kosher they wear a kippah. I mean, he's like Super Jew, right? So it's Super Jew in Super Jewish neighborhood on Super Jewish day on Yom Kippur, and it's in the afternoon, and it's right before Ne'ilah. Ne'ilah is perhaps, you know, Be'etni Ilat Shar, the closing of the gates. It's just before sunset. It's the moment when that window of opportunity that is Yom Kippur is about to close. Yom Kippur is such a powerful day. I think maybe because there's no other day where so many Jews stop what they're doing just to see if they can better themselves and the world around them. And that has enormous potential. And that window is about to close. And he comes out of synagogue because, I don't know, just needs to get some air before Nila. And, I don't know, maybe some kids are joyriding, and they're riding through Mea Shearim, and the music is blaring, and he can't take it. Now, this is a stereotype. I don't think people in Mea Shearim do this. I think the news has fun with this, but for the purpose of the discussion. So, I don't know, he picks up a rock, and he throws the rock at the car. So, put aside for the moment that the rock is muktzah, you can't pick it up. Put aside for the moment that, okay, that's what he does. Exact same moment. Exact same moment, across town, in Yerushalayim. Okay? Jewish guy, he's in his car, Yom Kippur afternoon. He's in his car, he's driving in his car. He's got a cigarette in one hand and a pork and cheese sandwich in the other. He's listening to the radio, I don't know, Come On Baby, Light My Fire, right? Am I dating myself, right? I mean, it doesn't get worse. Yom Kippur afternoon in the car with the cigarette and the cheese pork sandwich, Come On Baby, Light My Fire, on his way to a nursing home where he volunteers every week. Who's more religious? It's a ridiculous question. It's a ridiculous question. How do I know who's more religious? You know, there's a Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. It says, "Heveidan kol adam lekavzchut." Judge every person meritoriously. And again, this is just 2 minutes worth because I want to get back to our topic, but you need to have this framework. And I warn you in advance, if we ever meet again, you will never meet me without at some point this coming up, because I think that if you walk away with nothing else from this whole week but this idea, I'll be happy. There's a Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot. It says, "Heveidan kol adam lekavzchut." Judge every person meritoriously. Assume the best about every person. Okay? That's very easy to say. It's very hard to do. You see me walking into a... Do they have McDonald's here? Baruch Hashem. You see me walking into a McDonald's, getting a cheeseburger with a prostitute on my arm. You have to assume that I just found out that my life is in danger unless I eat cheeseburgers every day, and that on the way to fulfilling the mitzvah of Ushmartim et Nafshoteichem with cheeseburgers, right, to fulfill the mitzvah of saving your life, I met Nebuchadnezzar, a Jewish orphan girl, and I'm trying to help her. And this has to be such a natural assumption that you don't think about it. Oh, he's probably, on the cheeseburger diet, she's a Jewish orphan, come on, we got to get to the store. Like, it's natural. So it's easy to say, it's hard to do. Judge every person meritoriously. Imagine how different life would be if we could really do that. The very next Mishnah. Not somewhere off in the Jerusalem Talmud. Mamash, the very, very next teaching in Pirkei Avot, what does it say? It says, Harchaik mishachein ra. Distance yourself from an evil neighbor. Judge every person meritoriously. Very next teaching, distance yourself from an evil neighbor. Ask me an obvious question. Ask me an obvious question. No? How could you have an evil neighbor if you're judging every person meritoriously? Right? So Shimshon Farl Hirsch has a great line. He doesn't say it quite this way, but basically what he says is, okay, get a life. There is evil in the world. Nobody expects you to open up a yeshiva in a brothel. You have to recognize, you don't have to move in next door to a crack house. But judge the action and not the person. Judge the action. The act of throwing a rock at another human being is a deeply irreligious act. It's not a Jewish act. The act of visiting a nursing home is a deeply Jewish act. The act of eating a pork and cheese sandwich in a car on Yom Kippur, that's not a Jewish act. The act of fasting on Yom Kippur and davening and coming out for Nila, that's a deeply Jewish act. How do we judge the totality of a person? How do we decide to call a person religious? I hope I'm more religious today than I was yesterday. I hope I'll be more religious tomorrow than I am today. And that's a good start. By the way, I'll tell you something interesting, and I may be wrong, but I have yet to find it. I have not succeeded in finding a source in traditional Jewish texts, in the Gemara and the Medrash, using the word dati to define a person, the totality of a person is religious. You can find many sources that talk about actions, which are not acceptable, philosophies, which are not acceptable, but to judge the totality of a person, we love to put people into boxes. We love that. Because when we put a person into a box, it makes it easier. He's in that box, I don't have to worry about him. Life is a little more challenging. Which brings us back to the question that's worth struggling with tonight. So what is this mitzvah? How do you tell someone off for what he's doing? You're walking down the street. I don't know. Let's assume it's called Nidre night. Call Nidre night. And let's assume that the president of the shul, who's the president of the shul here? Pick a ganza, Rabbi Perez. Rabbi Perez, let's be safe. Rabbi Perez, because you shouldn't think about people if they're not here. So Rabbi Perez walks into shul on Kol Nidre night, smoking a cigarette. So what do you do? On the one hand, this is Amitecha. You love him, he's your Rav. You have to tell him off. On the other hand, you sit there, you think, it can't be. It just can't be. Havidan kol adam lekavschut. It must be that he just discovered the first disease, lo aleinu, that's cured by smoking cigarettes. How do you do that? How do you ever tell anyone off? And what's the point? I mean, if I'm telling you off, and this is a halacha, by the way. Now there's a debate, the Gemara in Erechin and Daftet Zayin on the 16th folio has a big debate. Does Tochacha exist today? Are we on the level? In fact, Rabbi Chiya actually suggests that there is no mitzvah anymore of Tochacha, of telling a person off, because I'm going to tell you off. For the language of the Talmud is, I'll tell you, tul korah mi bein inecha, take the beam from between your eyes. In other words, look what you're doing. You'll tell me, tul kisam mi bein inecha, take the toothpick from out of your teeth. In other words, look what you're doing wrong. All I do when I tell someone off is, you're telling me off? So maybe the Chofetz Chaim could tell people off, but there is a mitzvah, and most poskim say that there is a mitzvah. There is a mitzvah to tell someone off, under the right circumstances. So how do you do that? How could you ever know who the person is that you could tell them off? I want to give you a very difficult example of what I think we're missing with relation to this mitzvah. Here, I'll help you out here, right? This is like passing the baton in a relay race, right? Listen to this Gemara. This is just an unbelievable Gemara. Okay? The Gemara says like this. Okay? I don't think it's accidental that this Gemara is in, that this Talmudic discussion is on the daf in Chulin. Chulin is a very technically minded Talmudic tractate. It deals largely with the laws of Kashrut. In fact, you know, you expect at least to start the Talmudic discussion, what is Kashrut? Why is Kashrut? The Talmud doesn't waste time with theology right away. They want to first get you into the halachic detail so that you know that that's really what keeps us together as a people. Chezkat ha-sakin, otherwise known in the yeshiva world as chezkat ha-sakin, right? If you drop a knife and it's a ritual slaughter knife and there's a nick, and what do you do? Very technical. I have to slaughter Rov Shnei Simanim. I have to make sure that the majority of the trachea and the esophagus are slaughtered. What about drisa? What about pushing? All sorts of different halachic questions. In the middle of this Gemara, and Daf Kufyud, listen to this story. By the way, I have to say one thing as a preamble to this story. There is an interesting question regarding what we call Agadata, or Agada. Agada are from the period of the Mishnah, Agadata from the period of the Talmud. The stories in the Talmud. Did they really happen? You read about Alexander the Great going up to heaven to battle with the angels. You read about Abraham, you know, sort of breaking idols in his father's store. Do I have to believe that those things happened? That is a very deep and legitimate debate among major Torah scholars. The Baal HaTanya seems to have felt, certainly one of the great rabbis in the last couple hundred years, founder of Lubavitch, author of the Shulchan Aruch Harav, that one has to assume that these stories happened, and that's debatable even if that's what he says, but that seems to me to be what he says. On the other hand, there are major Torah authorities, the Rashbam, who was one of the Balei Tosfot, the Ramchal, the Vilna Gaon. So it's a legitimate question whether these stories really happened, and I'm only telling you this because you need to understand where I'm coming from so that we can learn together. To me, the issue is not whether they really happened. It's almost irrelevant whether they really happened. The real issue is that Ravina and Ravashi at the end of the 6th century, or middle of the 6th century, chose to include these stories in the Talmud because they had a message. These stories hide the entire totality of the theology of Judaism. There's a message to these stories, and that's what I want to figure out. But this could easily have happened. I also want to say that no one here should assume that I have the audacity, or the arrogance, the chutzpah, to sit in judgment of Rav Chisda, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva of Sura. Baruch Hashem, I mean, I have a long way to go before I can do that sort of thing. So nobody should misunderstand that. But I think that we have to view these stories from our perspective and try to understand them. So listen to this story. This is an unbelievable story. Besura lo achle kachle. There's a halacha called kchal, kaf chet lamed. The kchal is the udder of the cow. Okay? Interesting question. If you slaughter a cow, and inside the udder there's milk. So everything that's in the cow after it's slaughtered has been ritually slaughtered and is kosher. It's not technically defined as milk. By the way, nobody should walk out of here with anything remotely resembling a psak halacha on these types of questions, a halachic ruling, baruch Hashem, you have a rav here, ein mor in halacha, you're not supposed to teach halacha. That's not the purpose of this discussion, this is a complicated issue, but for the purpose of discussion. So if you have an udder, and the udder is part of a slaughtered animal, the milk that's inside the udder may well not be milk. And therefore, it may be that you can eat that milk. It's not milk. And, you know, then the question becomes, well, so could you have an ice cream sandwich with that milk while you're eating a burger? I don't personally lie awake at night thinking of ways to do this, but theoretically you could do that. It's kind of like coconut milk. And there's a debate whether when you drink such milk, it might look like milk, you shouldn't eat it, but okay. So the two major yeshivot at the time in Babylon, in Bavel, Sura and Pompedita. In Sura, they didn't eat the chal. On principle. It has milk, it's not milk, people get confused. We don't eat Sura, we're machmir. We're stringent. Besua lo achli kachli, be Pompedita achli kachli, but in Pompedita, in the other yeshiva, they used to eat the chal, they used to eat others. Rami bar Tamrei, Dehu Rami bar Diklei, there's a fellow, he has a rather strange name, and that may well be part of the message, but we won't get there. He's Rami, the son of palm trees, or Rami, the son of date trees, whatever. It's a strange name. Nebuchadnezzar must have had interesting parents, okay? He was Mipumpedita. Ikla, and he visited or arrived, L'Sura b'mali yom d'kipui. He is in Sura, he's visiting Sura in Erev Yom Kippur. Now in Erev Yom Kippur, you know that we eat, we have a mitzvah to eat. On the eve of Yom Kippur, I'm very stringent about this mitzvah. You know, make sure to fulfill that mitzvah, right? So what's everybody doing? They're all shechting animals and getting ready for the big Yom Kippur fest. Because that's what Jews do, right? We just know how to eat. Okay. So, Afkinu kulei alma dekachlinu shadinu. So everybody is chopping off the cows and throwing them out. Now this guy, Azaliyu naktinu. This guy's in heaven because he comes from Pompedita and they eat the chal. So he's in chal heaven. So he's walking down the street and he's collecting all the cows and he's now got a great meal. Aiti lekamei de Rav Chisda. So they bring him in front of Rav Chisda, right? They haul him in before the Rosh Hashiva. What's going on? From a yid? He's eating cows? You're not in Queens here. You're in Lakewood. We don't do this sort of thing. So they bring him before Rav Chisda. Amalei amaiti avid hachi. He says, what are you doing this for him? I come from the place of Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda apparently was the Rosh Yeshiva of Pompedita. We eat chals. So I'm eating udders. Right? I'm an udder eater. Okay. So he says, V'leiklach, notin alav chumrei ha-makom she-yatza misham, v'chumrei ha-makom she-alach l'sham. Don't you know that you have to keep the stringencies of where you live and the stringencies of where you are? You should be machmir according to what they're machmir, and you should be machmir according to... It's just a big chumrah fest. Somebody once gave me a baseball hat that said, I'm machmir about stuff you never even heard of, right? Okay, so that's surah. A Malay, this guy was a wise aleck. You could tell he had a sharp answer. So a Malay, he says to Rav Chisda, chutz l'tchom machaltinu, I walked out of the city limits. If you walk 2,000 amot, right, this is a whole discussion on Shabbat, so I'm not in your jurisdiction. Technically, here's the city line, I stepped over here, I'm eating, I'm not in your community, I don't have a problem. Now you could almost imagine Rav Chisda starting to get annoyed. A shtickle chutzpah this guy has. Ubamet vatinu. She says, okay, so how did you eat it? What did you cook it with? What kind of sticks did you use? Amalei beputzenei. She says, well, you know, there were twigs at the sides of the vineyards. They fall off the vine. So I collected them. She says, nu, v'dilma miyayin nesach. Maybe they're from the vines of an idolatrous non-Jew. You're not allowed to gain pleasure from them. Aha! You should have been machmir. You should have been stringent. How could you do this? Amalei lachar shneim asar chodesh havi. I know that these were 12-month-old twigs. And because they were so old, they're not any more part of the halach of yayin nesach, of forbidden wine. So I'm good. He's got a halachic answer for everything, right? Amalei, so Rav Chisda says, Fidilma de Gezalhu, maybe they're stolen, maybe the owner of the field was collecting those twigs. You can imagine, Rav Chisda, he's now determined to get this guy. Because he was Mekel, right? He's being a little too lenient for our part of town. But he can't chap him. Maybe they're stolen. He says, no, they couldn't have been stolen, right? Why? The Yeush Bailim Have, because the owners clearly gave up on ever using these twigs. Rashi explains here There were like weeds and mold growing out of the twigs. Now, why a guy would be cooking udders with weeds and moldy twigs? No. Okay. So now Rav Chisda's on a roll. He's got to chop this guy. Everybody's watching. So he says, Chazya delo have manach tefillin. So he sees that this boy chukol, he's not wearing tefillin. Now back then, they used to wear tefillin all day. We don't do it, we're not on the level, but they used to wear, this guy, he's not wearing tefillin. So he says to him, Amar lei, my time alone manach tefillin? Why are you not wearing tefillin? What's the matter with you? Shagets. Amar lei, chole miayin have it. He's got an answer for everything. He says, no, I have some kind of a bowels disease. I got the runs. And in our yeshiva, Rav Yehuda Paskind, he ruled, Cholim Yayin Potter Min HaTfilin. If you constantly have to go to the bathroom, so you don't have to put on tefillin, because it's not respectable to the tefillin, take them on, put them off, whatever, you might have to run into the bathroom with them. Commentators explained that in Surah, they were very frum. Very frum. They wore the tefillin even when they were Cholim Yayin. Chazia, so he sees, Deloha V'Koram Yichute, he's not wearing tzitzis. So he says to him, Nu, I'm away, my time a late lachute, why are you not wearing tzitzis? Right, the stringes. Amalei talit shulahu. This is a borrowed shirt. For Rav Yehuda Amar, Rav Yehuda says, talit shulah kol shloshim yom p'tuah min tzitzit. You don't have an obligation to wear tzitzis on a shirt. Now, don't rule this way, but you don't have an obligation to wear tzitzis on a shirt if it's borrowed and it's less than 30 days. It's not mine, I don't have to put tzitzis on. Adahachi, while they're having this debate, this little student and Rav Chisda, who can't one-up him, Aitua lahu gavra, delo have moker avuha ve'imei. There was a fellow who was brought in before the court, he was hauled in, because he wasn't giving proper respect to his parents. Back in those days, the Bezdin, the Jewish rabbinical court, they had more teeth to them. So if you were caught not being respectful to your parents, your elders, they brought you in, they gave you a shtickle beating, which, you know, we're talking about doing maybe, reenacting this in educational institutions, but okay, right? Not, by the way, in schools with kids. No, for adults and show. But okay, fine. Right? So they bring this guy in, and he's going to get makat mardut. He's going to get a rabbinic punishment. Kaftuhu. And they're starting to hit him. Amalahu, one opinion is they tie him up. Amalahu shavku. Let him go. This Talmud, this student, is now yelling out to undo what Rav Chisda and his court are doing. A chutzpah. Shavku, let him go. The Tanya that it says in the Braita, kol mitzvah tasei, shematan schara betzida, ain't Beit Din Shel Mata Muzarin Aleha. Any positive commandment which is listed in the Torah with a reward, one of the things we learn from the Braita, from the Mishnaic period, is that you can't, a court cannot punish a person for that mitzvah. And this is an obscure Braita, but this student knew it, and apparently Rav Chisda didn't. So Rav Chisda says to him, finally he's beaten. He says to him, Chazina lach techarifa tuva. I see that you're very sharp. In other words, you're Talmud Chacham, you know what you're talking about. Amolei, ihavit ba'atrei de Rav Yehuda, achvina lachufai. If you would come to this base medrash, to the study hall of Rav Yehuda, back in Pumpatita, I would show you sharpness in learning. So what is this story? You want to know what bothers me the most about this story? Never mind what's going through Rav Chisda's mind. Now, this is a dangerous discussion. So this is just Bini Friedman supposing. This doesn't bear necessarily reality to the Gemara. Just, they bring in a guy, and he's the stereotype shagets. He's got no tzitzis. He's got no tefillin. He's out there eating udders. Every chumrah the neighborhood has, every stringency, he's lenient about. How can it be? You know what's missing from this Gemara? Think about this. It's Erev Yom Kippur. And you have a Jewish kid, and he has nowhere to go. And he's eating raw udders that he's cooking from twigs in the vineyard outside of town. He is so poor he doesn't have his own shirt. And no one invites him home for Suda to eat. That's the problem of this Gemara. And I wonder, maybe, if the reason that this Gemara is stuck right here in the middle of Chulin of such a technical Talmudic discussion, because it's almost as though the Talmud maybe wants to say, take a step back, as we delve deeper and deeper into the technical details of Halacha, which are important. Don't forget that if the technical detail of Halacha, the stringencies we sometimes take on, become so much the goal that we forget the person that they're supposed to avail, then something's wrong. Something's wrong. This, to me, is the epitome of the challenge. And I want you to know, we live in a world, we love extremes. Extremes, I want you to know, are much easier. If you're all the way to one side or all the way to the other, you don't have to worry that you're headed in the wrong direction. And there are two extremes. Sometimes people, and by the way, nobody should misinterpret this to mean that there's any particular Jewish group. This is a state of mind. And I really don't think it's limited to any particular group or any particular neighborhood or any particular ideology. It's just sometimes the state of mind. Sometimes people, they get so into the halachic detail, the law, that they forget the love. They lose sight. What's the purpose? Why are we here? What's the purpose of the Jewish people? The Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim in the Guide to the Perplexed suggests that we're supposed to be a light unto the nations. We're supposed to create an ethical role model. If we're supposed to create an ethical role model, then every piece of Judaism is designed to teach me an ethical message. That its short-term goal is to make of me an ethical person. If I'm so involved in the detail of the law that I forget what it is to be a mensch, something's wrong. That's one extreme. I know exactly how to make a cup of tea on Shabbos, according to all the shittos, and I'm debating whether I should follow the Urim. But if you make a cup of tea on Shabbos the wrong way, the cup of tea becomes more important than the person. I once was at a Shabbaton. And you know, it's always a challenge. I always have this debate, because on the one hand, you know, we, at Israelite, we get Jews from all backgrounds. I have people who have a very little background, and I have people they could be learning in the mirror, they could be students in Gush, and they can tell you all the different opinions as to how to wear tefillin, but they feel like they've lost a little of the excitement and the joy and the inspiration of putting tefillin on, so they come and spend a Shabbat. And it's nice to be in an atmosphere where you don't have to be one or the other. And by the way, that's something we've lost in our, what people call outreach education. We've lost the benefit of the joy, the balance, the totality of the community. And it creates all sorts of interesting challenges. And I have this challenge every time a student offers to get me a cup of tea. We're sitting Friday night, we'll have a tish, whatever it is, we're singing, you know, and somebody wants to get a cup of tea. Now, I don't know. There is a halachic paradigm for how you make a cup of tea on Shabbat. Right? One of the 39 categories of labor is that you don't cook. We don't cook on Shabbat. Right? 6 days a week we work. We produce, we make a difference in the world, we're partners with God. One day a week we try to take a step back, take a step off the production train, and think about why we're doing all this producing. And as a part of that exercise, we limit ourselves not to be productive in that way. We become creative instead of productive. We study Torah. We live in the moment. We're not in such a rush to get someplace, we're enjoying where we are. We run for 6 days a week and we're so busy, and one day we take stock and we think, okay, so what are we doing all this for? So therefore there are 39 categories of labor, and every time I choose not to do one of those categories of labor, I have an opportunity to consider why I'm not doing those categories of labor. Okay, so one of those categories of labor is to cook. You don't cook. And if you take raw tea leaves, most tea bags are raw tea leaves, and you put them in boiling water, they cook. So therefore you have a problem making a cup of tea. So what's the solution to that problem? Right? Again, without getting into halachic ruling, because you have a rav, but generally speaking, if you take hot water, right, from the item that cooks the hot water, whether it's the urn or on the fire, right, and you take from that urn, assuming you're not taking it right off the fire, and you take from that hot urn and you put it into a cup, now you've got a cup of boiling water, and then you pour that cup of boiling water into another cup, so that second cup loses its ability to cook. It's been transferred enough that something changes in that boiling water so that it doesn't cook. Not everybody agrees, but that's what most people think. Then I could put my tea bag into that second cup of boiling water. Okay. But I don't know if my student knows how to do that. And you know, you're in the middle of a discussion, somebody's going to get you a cup of tea, right? So I wouldn't stop saying, oh, you could, but could you take from the urn and pour into a boiling water and then pour into another cup of boiling water and then put the tea bag in? All because of everything I just said, that just kind of interrupts the flow of conversation. So I usually just say no thank you, right? And you can have a cup. That's actually how I started drinking coffee, because most authorities rule that coffee beans are already cooked. And we rule halachically that once something's cooked, if it's solid, you can't recook it, and therefore probably you don't have to do this with coffee. But again, don't rely on my statement and learn halachot, you have a rav. Okay. So I was once at a Shabbaton, and we're having the discussion, we're sitting around the table, and I hear from across the room, "What's the matter with you?" You can imagine. Somebody's making a cup of tea, they're doing it wrong, they're pouring for somebody else. So the cup of tea, Nebuch, the cup of tea becomes less important than the person. And by the way, that brings us back to our question. So how do I do that? How do I know who this person is? What is the true challenge of this mitzvah? So I want to share with you two or three ideas that I think changed the nature of how we view this halakha. And I'm not sure now this is going to be a halakhic discussion so much as a theological discussion. And in about 7 minutes we'll be done, and then I'll open the floor to questions. So here's an interesting thought. The Rambam says an amazing thing. You know, what does the word tochacha mean? What does it mean, hocheach tochiach? Right? Tochacha has the same root as the word lahochiach, which means, anybody? To prove. In fact, the English word for tochacha is to reprove. Right? To give reproval to someone, to tell someone off. What does it mean that I'm mochiach? What am I proving? Think about it. The real essence of tochacha is that I'm proving that I have a relationship with you. When you get into the halachot, the laws of tochacha, some of the things that come out are fascinating. For example, am I allowed to give you tochacha? Am I allowed to tell you off if I know you're not going to listen to me? No? How much do I have to assume you will listen to me? And by the way, what is the basis for my ability to assume, even if I'm mistaken, that you will listen to me? So listen to this Rambam. This is such a beautiful language. There's a set of halachot. It's called Hilchot Deot. Literally the laws of character traits. It is no small amount of angst for me that there's so many Jewish kids who learn the laws of Shabbat, and they learn the laws of Kashrut, and maybe even, if we're lucky, they learn the laws of Staka, but they don't study these laws. The Rambam has Maimonides has a magnum opus. He was a master organizer. It's called the Yad HaChazakah, 14 books that encompass the totality of Jewish law. His first section in the first book is Hilchot Yisodei Torah, the foundations of Torah. And this is really where he lays out the philosophical underpinnings of all of halacha. And it's funny, you would have thought that halacha should start with all sorts of laws. That's not how the Rambam starts. If you don't understand why these laws are important, you've missed the point. If you don't understand the theological message, if it doesn't mean something to you, then you've missed something. His second set of halachot are what's called Hilchot Deot, the laws of character traits. The Rambam actually has a series of chapters in which he defines the system based on halacha, on Jewish law, of how to become a mensch. And it's interesting that these laws, and I challenge you, with one exception, there's one chapter in the middle which is very difficult that deals with how the Rambam was a doctor. And he felt that what we eat affects our character and affects who we are and has mystical underpinnings. And that's a discussion for a question if you want in a few minutes. But the Rambam has a system for how to become a mensch. Who would have thought? Who would have thought to teach your student, teach your children, to learn, before you learn all the laws of Shabbat, before you learn all the laws of Kashrut, to learn how to become a mensch? And what the Rambam may be communicating, it's dangerous to put words into the Rambam, is if you're not going to learn how to be a mensch, what's the point? Now, by the way, nobody should misunderstand me. Don't walk away from this thinking that what's really important is to be a mensch. Judaism does not believe that it's enough to say, I'm going to be a mensch. If you don't have a system to practice menschlichkeit, if it isn't a part of your everyday, just the fact that you think tzedakah is a beautiful idea is not enough. If you aren't obligated to give tzedakah every day, you're not going to be a tzedakah-minded person. And so on and so forth. So in the laws of character trait development, the Rambam, by the way, this is the place right at the beginning where you will find that the Rambam says that there are different character traits. There is anger and there is lovingness, there is cruelty and there is kindness, and the goal is to be in the middle. This is the famous middle path of the Rambam. And the Rambam says if you find yourself veering in one direction, lean over to the other. If you think you're too cruel, if people tell you, you know, you're a hard person, and you want to correct yourself, for a while, become sickeningly, disgustingly nice. If you're the kind of guy who's rude to people, just start hugging everybody. And even though you don't feel it inside, your actions will affect who you are. You will become a better person. And then hopefully you'll get back into the middle. So what does the Rambam say? The Rambam says like this. Kishe yichta, this is in Perek Vav, Halacha Vav. Chapter 6, Halacha 6, very easy to remember. Kishe yichta adam, kishe yichta ish le ish. when a person does a transgression, when you do something wrong to your fellow man, lo yistemenu v'yishtok, you should not ignore it and be silent. Don't hold it in. If somebody wrongs you, don't think, I'm not going to say anything because, it's not worth it. If you feel wrong, now, the ideal would be to recognize that you're not being wronged, and we'll get to that in a minute because that's our last point. But if you're not capable of doing that, if you're not capable of letting go of it, if you're not capable of saying, I wasn't wrong because Hashem runs the world, then you have to say something. And the proof that the Rambam gives is fascinating. Avshalom has a sister named Tamar. Tamar is raped by Amnon, half-brother. David the king never really does anything about it. Avshalom bears tremendous anger towards Amnon and even more towards David. And because he holds it in, it eventually erupts and causes Merad Avshalom, the rebellion of Avshalom. Avshalom kicks King David, no less, out of the city of Jerusalem. They go to war, civil war. David is forced to fight his own son. The entire kingdom of David is almost destroyed. The future, therefore, of messianism in the Davidic dynasty is almost lost. All because, according to the Rambam, one individual held it in. Not healthy. Not healthy to let these things build up. If you have in your heart something that someone has done to you, and you feel you've been wronged, you have a halachic obligation, according to the Rambam, to be a mensch, and to go tell them. Now, you have to do it in such a way that you think they can hear it. And if you haven't spoken to them in God knows how long, you don't call them up and say, listen, I feel like I need to tell you why you're a pig. You have to do it gradually. But if you want to go into Yom Kippur with a clean heart, you have to do the tough things. The tough things are not cleaning out your house from chametz. These are the tough things. Then the Rambam says an amazing thing. He says, "El mitzvah alav lahodio." There's a mitzvah to tell him, to let him know. And then he says, "Haro'eh havero." If a person sees his friend, now this is interesting. In the first halacha it says, "K'sheyechta ish l'ish," when an ish does something against me. But here it's, "I see havero, my friend." Haro'eh havero, if a person sees his friend, shechata, who transgressed, o she'alach b'derech lo tova, or is pursuing a bad path, mitzvah lahachziro lamutav, it's a mitzvah to sort of bring him back to a good way, ulahodio shehu chotei al atzmo, and to let him know that he is transgressing against himself. I want you to hear this. First, chavero has to be his friend. You can't tell someone off if they're not your friend. If you don't love them, you can't tell them off. And by the way, when you don't even feel like telling them off, it's because you don't love them. The mitzvah of tochacha is not just about the other person. The mitzvah of tochacha is also about me. If I walk down the street, and I don't know, I heard that they have these tours of like the townships, right? You can go tour Soweto. And that's not really high on my list of priorities, but okay, right? But I can understand people want to feel what happened here. So you're walking down a street in Soweto, and you see some kid, and I don't know, he's shooting up or whatever. I don't know the area here. I'm walking in Harlem, in the Bronx, in New York, and some kid on the corner is shooting up. Right? Not a good thing. Do I stop my day? Do I call an ambulance? Do I do everything I can to get the needle out of his hand? No. I say, I feel bad, maybe I'm a little shocked, and I go on with my day. Huh. But if that would be Chas v'Shalom, my son, the world would stop. Could you imagine that there could be anything you could be doing for the rest of the month that wouldn't get put off if Chas v'Shalom, you were walking down the street and your son was shooting up on a street corner in the Bronx? The only fundamental difference between those two people is that I have a deep relationship with my son, Baruch Hashem, and I love him very much. And what that means is that the relationship, it's the function of the relationship that causes me to stop what I'm doing. Which means that when I see a boy who I don't even know, and I don't do anything about it, it's because I have no relationship with him. It's because I don't love him enough. Now, this may be perfectly normal. It's reasonable. We can't love the whole world, at least not most of us. I think that's part of the definition of a tzaddik. Tzaddik is a person capable of such an enormous amount of love that they can love you even if they don't know you. Most of us are not on that level. But it should bother us that we're not on that level. Part of the mitzvah of tochacha is not whether I actually tell someone off. It's that I see someone doing something, and I struggle with whether I should tell them off, and I realize the fact that I can't tell them off is because I'm not close enough to them. I have no hesitation whatsoever. If I see my kids doing something that bothers me, no hesitation whatsoever in stopping what I'm doing and telling them off. And I know exactly, I hope, how to tell them off in a way that they can listen to it. There's no point in telling someone off if he's not going to listen. I'm absolutely convinced that they know that it's coming from a place of love. I have enough of a relationship that I can follow up with it. That there's a whole question, you know, when Rav Tursky came to Efrat, Rabbi Abraham Tursky, who's been here, we were talking about this today. When he was a boy, his father, when he would tell him off, he would never say, you're bad. He would say, it's pasnished. Right? It doesn't become you. In other words, you're so good that this action doesn't fit you. Even when I'm telling you off, I've never told my children they're bad. Because they're not that. Kids can't be bad. I've always told them I expect more of you. In other words, you're so great that this doesn't fit you. It's the action that's the problem. That's the way we should talk to anyone. Because who could ever be bad? How could a person be bad? So when I see someone, and they're making, by the way, it's interesting, the word that we use is chait. Chait is not a sin. Sin is a Christian word, it's not a Jewish word. Chait is a mistake. In modern Hebrew, I say lachti et hamatara. If I'm shooting at a target range and I miss the mark, it's called lachti. Chait is a mistake. I've made a mistake. We make mistakes. You steal some money, you've made a mistake. If you really understood that your purpose in this world was to make the world a better place, if you understood that your purpose was to become a better person, so you just took a detour. And that's a mistake. And that has to bother me because I want you to be a better person because I love you. And that's what the word tochacha means. When I tell someone off, I'm proving just how much I love them. And if I can't tell them off, which in my opinion is most cases, then it means that I've proven to myself that I don't love them enough. And of course then the question is, do I make the effort to get to love them enough? To develop a relationship with them? Because the more we develop our relationships with each other, the more we learn to love each other, the better the world becomes. That's pashut, that's simple. Which leads me to the last point, and then we'll open up the floor to questions. Because there is one detail here that's worth thinking about, you know. The Baal Shem Tov says an amazing thing. He says, you know, if you see somebody, I don't know, let's say being Mechalel Shabbat, transgressing Shabbat, don't assume that the reason that you're seeing a person transgressing Shabbat is because you have to scream Shabbos. If you're seeing someone transgress Shabbat, there's a message for you. You have a problem with your Shabbat. You need to work on yourself. It's a little harder to turn the mirror on ourselves. I remember once, when I was back from the army, I went to Gush, Yeshivat Hesder, and we'll finish with this, which is a place where boys do the army and learn in yeshiva. And the Rosh Yeshiva of Lichtenstein Rav Amital believed very strongly that the boys in yeshiva should contribute to the welfare of the town in which the yeshiva is situated. So we would always participate in guard duty around the town. And the middle of the night patrols, and every student would participate, even American boys who came, South Africans, Australians, who would come, usually within 3 or 4 weeks, they would be taken to a shooting range, they would be trained on weapons, they would be taught the safety rules, and they would do patrol and guard duty along with, you know, and you know how it is, at the beginning, I found once a picture of my Shana Aleph year, you know, like 3 months after I got to yeshiva, I'm doing guard duty with an M16, there's a picture of me like this, you know, because you think it, and after a while, you know, it gets a little tiring, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's raining, and it's cold, then the reality of it sets in. So when you did middle of the night patrols, they would always put an older guy who'd been through the army, for obvious reasons, with the new guys, they shouldn't be doing patrol alone at night. So we're doing patrols, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm like Shana Vav, I'm already studying in the Kollel, I think I'm already studying for the rabbinate, for Smicha, I'm an officer, I've been through the army, and there's a new boy, a Shana Aleph boy. And we're having a great discussion, we're talking, he starts telling me a joke. 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning, kind of the guards fall down, you know. Starts telling me a joke. About 30 seconds into the joke, I realize, this is a dirty joke. And I can't believe it. We're in yeshiva, walking around Gush. We're doing guard duty, which I think is a mitzvah. I'm a smicha student, and he's telling me a dirty joke? I wanted to slap him. And then I think, like, I don't want to embarrass him. I didn't know what to do. And then I started thinking about it, you know. If Rav Lichtenstein, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, would be walking with this guy would never be telling him a dirty joke. So he must think I'm the kind of guy who likes to hear a dirty joke. So the joke's on me. I have to try to become the person that no one would ever imagine they could tell a dirty joke to. That's a whole different way of looking at the world. Sometimes when we're not ready to be mochiach, when we're not ready to be prove how we relate to others, we can at least prove what we need to learn for ourselves. And Yehi Ratzon Bezrat Hashem, that we succeed in taking a little bit of this home. That we change the way we look at the world. That we change the way we look at others. That we learn to see the lining instead of sometimes the dirt that's inside the pockets. And I thank you all for coming. I know not an easy thing to come out at night and to sit up late and to learn. And I hope that if you got half out of this, what I got out of it, then you had a pleasant evening. I want to open the floor, if that's okay, to a few questions. If anybody has questions on anything, on this topic, on Judaism in general, no Taoism. Yes. What about love your fellow human being as yourself? Okay. Can you love everyone? Good question. It's an interesting thing. You know, we live in an illusion. We think that there's you and there's me, right? And we're all different individuals, right? You look at Rabbi Perez, Doron, right? And Benny Friedman, and there's Doron and there's Benny, right? Okay. Let me ask you a question. There's two parts to who we are. There's the physical. This is the physical. And then there's the spiritual. There's the part of us that we can't define. It's the part of us that's limitless, that has the ability to give and to share and to love. The neshama, the soul. The part of us that can experience things that are indefinable. The part of us that can get beyond our natural animal-like instincts to limit, to hang on to our food, and want to give. Now one day, Bezrat Hashem, should be many years away, the physical part of us ends. Right? Ad mea vesrim. Right? And the physical being stops. And you put it in the ground and you show it some respect, and okay, we move on. But what happens to the spiritual piece? There's no reason to assume that the spiritual piece ends when the physical ends. So we've come up with all sorts of ideas, Olam Haba, Tchiyat HaMetim, whatever they might be, world to come. Here's an interesting question for you. You know, Maimonides says that God cannot be physical, because the definition of the physical is that it's here and it's not there. And God's everywhere. God can't be somewhere that he isn't somewhere else. Right? So this is not God-like. The definition of spiritual is that it's unlimited, right? The neshama has no space. It's kind of like closely related to light. Okay? You know, that there's a light over there, and there's a light over there. And we know that the light in this room comes from all these lights. But you can't point to a piece of light and say which piece of light is from this light and which piece. It becomes one. So imagine that Rabbi Perez and I had finished our physical existence on this world, lo aleinu, yesterday afternoon. And now we're neshamot. How would you be a soul? How would you be able to tell the difference between my soul and his soul? Right? They're unlimited. They're endless. How would you tell the difference? The answer is you wouldn't. Because you would discover that they're really one. All of our neshamot are really part of one. It's just that we live in a world of illusion where the physical gets in the way and we think we're other. And we experience a taste of the world to come, by the way, when we tap into the fact that we're really all one. That's why Shabbat is a taste of the world to come, because we put aside our differences. That's why marriage is supposed to be a taste of the world to come. That's why those experiences where we really feel one with something are such spiritual experiences. So, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, to love your fellow as yourself, has two issues. One is to recognize that your fellow and yourself are really very much connected. We really already are one. And the other is that you have to love yourself in order to love your fellow. Any other questions? Yes. Okay, so I want to tell you. Did everybody hear the question? But just to repeat the question, a fellow was in a synagogue on Shabbat morning, Shabbat before a child's wedding or something, and he was called up to the bima to receive an aliyah to go up to the Torah. Okay. And someone there asked him, doesn't matter who, you know, are you Shomer Shabbat? Do you keep regularly celebrate Shabbat? Right? He said, no. She said, well, I'm sorry, then you can't have an aliyah. You can't make a blessing over the Torah. Okay. So this fellow, I gather, was rather turned off. Okay. So first of all, I want you to know, I have an opinion, it's just my opinion, that Hashem has a great sense of humor. I just think Hashem has a great sense of humor. I remember I was once at the Kotel, and we were above at Israelite, and there was a whole story, and there was a woman who came in, she was on the verge of tears. It turned out she was from a Reform synagogue, she was a cantor, she hadn't been in Israel in 10 years. She happened to come, there's a group called Women at the Wall, which is women of various denominations. You have Frum, Haredi women, whatever those labels means, you have Reform women, they all get together, and they have a tefillah service together every Rosh Chodesh. And the idea there is that women should get to know different types of women, and they should create unity and achdut, and they do it privately and whatever, fine, right? And they don't read from the Torah, and they don't, but they, whatever. So you have some women who are wearing a talis, because they're Reform, whatever. And you have some women who are, you know, tickled up to their eyebrows, and everywhere in between. Okay. And we on occasion have let them use the area below Israelite, you know, because when they go down to the Kotel, sometimes they get into a lot of trouble. And I'm not talking about the halachic ramifications, and what works and what doesn't, and fine. Anyway, so they did this tefillah, and this woman happened to pop in on them, and she was so enjoying it, and she started to realize how many different denominations were there, and they went down to the kotel, and things got a little out of hand. Some women started singing, some people got very upset, and it got so bad that a fellow, rather zealous fellow, I imagine, picked up a bench and threw it over the mechitza at the women, right? Because they're desecrating the kotel, whatever it might be. Anyway, so this woman was hysterical, and, you know, she wasn't even part of this group. The police came, they wouldn't let them go up to the kotel. She said, look, I'm not really this group. I came, I waited for 10 years to come to Israel, I want to go to the kotel. You can't go to the kotel. She was hysterical, she was walking back up the steps, she was basically ready to go home. And then she happened to run into some of our students, and they saw this woman, Neba, crying, and they were talking to her, and they said, well, why don't you come, we're about to go to a class. Anyway, she came, she did Israelite for a week, well, it worked out. So I have this theory that when this guy who threw this bench gets up to Shamayim, right, to heaven, so Hashem is going to come out to greet him, and she's going to be wearing tefillin, right? You know, Akash Baruch Hu has a sense of humor. That's just my opinion, right? So, you know, you ask a Jew, are you Shomer Shabbos? So he'll get to Shamayim, and Akash Baruch Hu says, so are you Shomer Adam? You know, I'm not going to get into the halachic question. There is a legitimate halachic question, right, about, not just about how you handle those situations, my personal opinion, and I'm going to be very careful to stay away from ruling or giving you a halachic opinion or a theological opinion, especially when I don't know all the circumstances. I don't know who the fellow was. I don't know who the rabbi was. I don't know what the policy of the shul is. I don't know why the policy of the shul is. I can tell you that if I had a shul, that would not be my policy. And I think there's a lot of halachic room to maneuver in these policies, and there are dispensations, and some of these things are based on responsum that existed at a different time. There's a famous responsum of the Chasam Sofer, who was one of the great rabbis of Pressburg when the Reform movement was starting to gather speed. By the way, just so we're all on the same page here, you can only disagree with someone or something when you respect where they're coming from. Opinions that are different from yours usually begin from a good place. Sometimes they get distorted. The Reform movement started as a magnificent idea. For 1800 years we've lived in exile. For 1800 years we've lived in the ghetto. Now finally the world wants to welcome us in. They're giving us voting rights. They're giving us land rights. We've developed this incredible ethical system. Let's embrace the world. Let's assimilate into the world. What better way to inculcate Jewish values into the world than to be with them in the bedroom, in the boardroom, everywhere? By the way, that's why the Reform movement originally was vehemently against the establishment of the State of Israel back in the early Zionist Congress days, because they felt the State of Israel would be another ghetto. That's why early Reform rabbis did not wear a kippah, because they felt it was a goal to assimilate. And Baruch Hashem, the Reform movement is starting to come full circle. They're now taking on all sorts of ritual, encouraging people to keep kosher and use mikvah. So it started as a beautiful idea. The fact that I think it was misguided and mistaken, that's a separate issue. You can disagree with someone, you can even vehemently disagree with someone, if you respect where they're coming from. And there may be people here who vehemently disagree with me, but okay. So I don't know where this person's coming from, and I don't know where that person's coming from. So I don't want anybody to misinterpret this as a commentary on that particular story, because you have to get to know people. It's the same example. Just like I wouldn't personally stand at a bima and say something remotely resembling Tochecha are you Shomer Shabbos, right? Whatever that means. Okay? I wouldn't proceed to give Tochecha to the person who said that, because I don't know him either. Right? So that's an interesting dilemma. By the way, the word Shomer Shabbat is a very interesting word. You know, what does it mean, lishmor Shabbat? Most people think it means to keep Shabbos, to guard Shabbos. There's another way to look at it, right? In Israel, you know, if you're driving into town, and I need to get my son into town, but I don't have a car, and you're going that way, so I give you my son, and I say, listen, do me a favor, you know, take him to town, and you say, sure. And I say to you, rak shmor alav, take good care of him, because my children are my most special thing in the world. Lishmol is also to cherish. V'shamru b'nei Yisrael t'Shabbat means they cherish Shabbat. They loved it. You take close care. You know, Menachem Begin, I went to we had election day in Israel. And I was sort of struggling, so what do you do on election day? On the one hand, Nebuch, you know, you could read Tehillim or say Lamentations on this election day. On the other hand, we live in a state of Israel with a Jewish army, in a Jewish land, with all its problems, after 2,000 years, and we're electing a government according to Rav Kook. Rav Kook understood the Rambam, Maimonides, that when the majority of the Jewish people live in Israel, if they will elect amongst them a government, that government will have certain halachot of malchut, of kingship, mamash malchut. That's why Rav Kook believed that the chief rabbinate should be elected by the Knesset. The chief rabbi of Israel is an elected representative of the elected representatives of the Jewish people. And there are certain halachot of malchut. And for the first time in 2,000 years, we're actually just about at a point where the largest Jewish community in the world is in Israel. And I would say it's about 25 or 30 years where the majority of the Jewish world is all in Israel. So, to have a day like that, with all of its challenges, and not to feel that this is a unique event, a special event, something to be appreciated, is also something wrong. So we did what we did, but in the afternoon, we, after voting and getting together with friends and, you know, having a little tefillah, so we went to the Begin Center. This is, by the way, a magnificent place. I urge you to go there. It's right across from the Old City. You know, it to me, the fact that there are bin centers out in Tel Aviv and the Begin Center is opposite the Old City of Yerushalayim represents all the difference that was between them. And with all the respect that I have for Rabin, I met Rabin a number of times, and I believe that he did a lot for the state of Israel, despite what he didn't do for the state of Israel. But okay. So Begin, in 1977, when he was elected Prime Minister of Israel, and if you know Begin's story, I mean, this is a person who was almost killed by the Russians, who escaped the Holocaust, who was in hiding with a price on his head from the British, who sat in opposition for 29 years, who gave probably the most Gorali, the most fatefully difficult decision when he gave the order not to fire back when the early vestiges of the Haganah bombed and destroyed the Altalina, killing 11 of his men, preventing basically a civil war. When he put aside all his political differences and went to see David Ben-Gurion and said in 1956, Anachnu itchem, we are with you, we'll put aside our differences. He was a man of vision. He was finally elected government. There was a story the day before he was elected. There was a rally. Dudu Topaz, who was a young rising star in the entertainment world, made a famous speech in which he said basically, you know, who do you think is going to, you know, he was giving a rally for the Avodah, for the Labor Party. Who do you think is going to elect the Prime Minister of Israel? Do you think it's going to be the bus drivers? Do you think it's going to be the Chachachim? Right? The what's Chachachim in English? I don't know.
Delinquents.
The delinquents? The next day, right? Do you think the Iraqis are going to elect the next prime minister? Because back then there were still very serious issues between the Sephardic world and the Ashkenazic world. The next day, Begin stood up and he said, bus drivers, chachchachim, what's a chachchach? I never heard the word until yesterday. He says, Iraqim, Iraqi Jews, German Jews, they're all Jews. And everybody went nuts and that rolled him into the government. And he was elected prime minister against all expectations. The first thing he did, the first act he did as a prime minister, there was a boat of Vietnamese fishermen that was trying to escape Vietnam because of persecution, and they were sailing the waters of the world. No Asian country would take them in. His first order as prime minister was, Israel will take them in. He felt that's what an Israeli government should do. His second order of business was to go to the Kotel. He went to the Kotel, and he took out a Tanakh that his wife had given him when he was freed from prison labor camp in Siberia. And he kept that Tanakh with him all the years. He used to learn from it every day when he was hiding underground with a price on his head from the British. And he took that Tanakh to the Kotel. I imagine, who shamar ala Tanakh hazeh? He guarded that Tanakh. He cherished it very closely. This is our biggest problem. Our problem is, really what you could answer to that person is, so tell me, are you Shomer Shabbat? Do you love Shabbat? Do you cherish Shabbat? Is Shabbat beautiful? Is it meaningful to you? Is it a magnificent experience? Or is it how you make tea? So all I can tell you is, you come over afterwards, get my email, I'd love to talk to this fellow. With the greatest of pleasure, the one who didn't get an aliyah, and he's invited to come to Israel, and to come to Israelite, and to join us on the rooftop of Ulluming Har HaZitim, and I'll give him an aliyah. A ganza aliyah.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.